work session for the October 3rd work session of the Planning Commission of the City of Springfield. And this evening, we will be discussing in the encouragement of accessory dwelling units by the City of Springfield Development Code. And Sandy Belson, staff, is here to review information with us. We've already had discussion about this. This was a meeting that you had while I was enjoying my time in Maui. But I've read the attendant information, and so we'll turn it over to Sandy, and we'll move through this process.
Thank you. So as I mentioned during your previous meeting as the CCI, we have scheduled a public hearing for October 17th. So this work session is a way for you to be prepared for that hearing, to be able to see the evolution of the code amendments, to start to review the public comments that we've gotten from the open house and the Historic Commission, and to get you to start thinking about whether or not the proposed code amendments warrant some further changes to respond to public comment or to add clarity to what is required. So I'm going to take you through a brief PowerPoint to get you in tune with these, and also just point out that we had these displays at the open house, we had some other things there too, but I thought these might be useful to just get in mind some images of what is possible or that you like or don't like or with the accessory dwelling. So to set the context, the program to encourage accessory dwelling units is part of council's strategies to address housing needs. There's other strategies in this whole spectrum of strategies to address the full housing continuum, include expanding the overnight parking program, contributing to income-qualified housing, such as the Royal Building that was built by St. Vincent de Paul, to secure property targeted for residential development, and so we're using our community development block grant funds potentially for purchasing property and looking at publicly owned property that could be used for residential development. We currently have two programs that assist homeowners with community development block grant funds. So one is our SHOP program, so that provides home buyers, first-time home buyers, qualify with down payment or closing cost assistance. We also have the home repair program that provides services to low-income homeowners who need help with repairs or accessibility improvements to be able to stay in their homes safely. And then the last strategy is to promote housing of diverse types. So the encouraging construction of ADUs has three components. One of them is to waive the system development charge, which have been waived and is in place for 2 years. Secondly, to promote awareness about the possibilities.
So the city has already taken action on waiving the, and I recall that.
Yes. And then the third is what you're here for tonight. To revise the development code to make it easier and potentially less expensive to add an accessory dwelling. So as you go into these amendments, there are some considerations to keep in mind that we're trying to encourage development by reducing the regulatory hurdles, but at the same time, we need to be protecting the character of the existing neighborhoods in the city. And so how do we find that balance and keep those two aspects in mind as we go through these code amendments? So I pulled out the key changes that are being proposed, and there's a slide for each. So per your direction, we are looking at allowing accessory dwelling units on properties that are within the Washburn Historic District, and then also that, as directed by council, medium density zoning, and then as directed by legislation, we included high density, because the legislation requires all zoning districts that allow single-family homes to also allow accessory dwellings. Again, this was from the Planning Commission, to remove the minimum size requirement of 300 square feet, and so this drawing is an example of one house being constructed at Emerald Village, and all of the homes constructed at Emerald Village in Eugene are smaller than 300 square feet. This one is 268, excluding the storage on the right-hand side. Per council's direction, to remove the ratio requirement, so currently an accessory dwelling unit cannot be greater than 40% of the main dwelling floor area, excluding garage, so allowing it to be smaller than, as long as it's not larger than 750 square feet. So this example is one in Portland that I saw, where this small house in front, if our 40% requirement was in place, that dwelling, that accessory dwelling would not be allowed to be as big as it is. Here's an example in Springfield where the front house was the small enough to become the accessory dwelling, and then the primary dwelling built behind.
In a case such as that, the large unit built in the back, being built as the primary, would still be required to pay the SDCs.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
Okay. But then how would they recover the SDC costs if they wouldn't?
They wouldn't.
Yeah.
Because
so it would only be, it would only be in a situation where you, you're in the primary dwelling, you, you build an ADU, it would waive the SDCs. Right? Okay.
Sequence.
Yeah.
And that's my understanding. Council could adjust that. Otherwise, they did ask for a year check-in to see how things were going. So there could be a change to that if council so desired. But then we'd have to think about how they would credit that.
And just FYI, there. Those are city SDCs. Willamette Lane SDCs are still on the books.
As are MWMCs.
Right, exactly.
The Metropolitan
Wastewater SDCs are also still there.
Well, I was going to say, if it was done in this sequence, you're looking at considerably more SDC for the primary being secondary than the other way around because of the size of the structure.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
So this, the reduction of SDCs or deletion of SDCs for the time being is an incentive for people to do ADUs, right? So does that affect people doing internal ADUs, incentive program?
Yes. Does it matter what type of ADU?
Yeah. Okay.
If you added, like, you'd have to add bathrooms and stuff.
Right.
And I think transportation would be a, yeah. Mm-hmm.
A proposal to allow more flexibility in the location of the entrance to the accessory dwelling. So here's a case where there's a basement accessory dwelling and the main dwelling is up above. Both doors are facing the street.
Right.
Although from the street you probably wouldn't see that basement door because it's blocked by the staircase. But allowing that flexibility of the location allows this configuration. Council direction to waive on-street parking requirement for the ADU if there is no on-street parking available that abuts the property, and we worked on some language around that last time, and that there are no adopted plans to remove the on-street parking. So this would be an example, and I have not gone and personally checked this, but I've told that there are some units in the back. So this slide gives the idea that if you have a paved parking, I mean a paved driveway that leads to parking, then the parking wouldn't have to be paved. Now, this example does not provide the 18 feet from the property line that we would require to be paved, but it gives you the idea of what we're looking at, as well as being a nice thought. Removing the requirement for the property owner to live on site, which means that both units could be rentals. Allowing manufactured homes, type 2 are the smaller manufactured homes, and approved total structures as an ADU as long as they are permitted, inspected, and approved by the local authority, with a footnote that in the historic district, all ADUs must meet the historic district's alteration standards. And then also allowing more options for meeting the design standards, with again a caveat that in the historic district they would have to meet the alteration standards for the district. So that highlights the changes. There are some others that are less substantive that are included in your packet. And then also handed out on your table is the recommendation from the Historic Commission. So I'll talk about that first. There was unanimous support for accessory dwelling units. They had no issues with using on-street parking to meet the parking requirement. They did raise the idea that they don't want any new driveways on the, because that's part of that characteristic of a historic neighborhood to have lawns without driveways in front of the homes. So any parking would either have to be on the street or with from alley access, as long as that was an option. Available. If there was no other way to provide the needed parking, then you could look at adding a driveway. But that was their concern or view on parking. They don't want manufactured homes, but think that the alteration standards would prohibit that type of unit anyway. They just want to be clear that that's their expectation. And I'm sorry, I skipped to number two there. They do not want to have the door for both dwellings, if they're in the same building, to be facing the same street. And they really struggled with the owner occupancy question. So there's mixed feelings about that. There are also code provisions in the historic district that require a business that is housed within the Washburn to be allowed only if the property owner lives on site. So there would be a good tie-in to that in terms of requiring the owner of the accessory dwelling unit to live on site. So they didn't come to a conclusion and decided to schedule their next meeting, their November meeting, in time to be able to discuss it further and have input into the council's recommendation. So they don't have a recommendation for you at this time for the Washburn District, but that is an issue that is under their consideration.
And they will not have anything prior to our public hearing.
Not unless your hearing is extended beyond
right.
Their next meeting date of November 16th.
Okay.
In terms of process, they found that an accessory dwelling unit within the Washburn would be an increase in intensity of use and therefore warrant a type 2 procedure. So type 2 land use decision would require notice to surrounding property owners, and that would also ensure that there is some review of the alteration standards to apply to that, and people could comment on whether they were meeting those alteration standards when in adding their accessory dwelling.
Does staff concur with that?
Yes. And then they also suggested adding some guidelines to the Springfield Historic Design Guidelines specific to accessory dwellings. So we will enter this into the record at your next public hearing as formal testimony, but this
Good.
Is for you to start thinking about now.
Good.
And then the other item was a compilation of the open house comments. And in general, they were positive. The concerns that were raised during that open house were around allowing mobile homes, as I said, although we would only allow manufactured homes.
So there is a, by definition, there's a difference between a manufactured home.
It's a date on when it was constructed, and that construction date affects the standards.
Okay. But a manufactured home can have wheels under it and be drug in and set down and the wheels taken off and it set on a foundation, right? It's really date of construction. Okay.
And then there's also some concern raised about the owner occupancy not requiring that any further. And then a question about the maximum size of the dwelling and whether there could be some correlation to the lot size for that. So that's a summary of these comments. Again, we're not in deliberation, so you're not needing to make any decisions tonight, but this is a work session for you to ask questions or discuss options. Are things that you would want staff to look into further. Before we get there, or I'll just say I have one more item to talk about. At your last meeting, you asked about the parking requirements and what other jurisdictions are doing, so I could also report on that, or we could talk about what I've presented so far.
Why don't we talk about what's been presented thus far, so we don't get too far downstream, and then we'll address it. Any comments related to the Historic Commission's feedback on process? Yes,
Commissioner Vogt. That's what I want to ask: is the process, is the thoughts of the Historic Commission going to be included as a recommendation to the City Council when it reaches
yes,
them?
That's what it sounds like to me.
Well, they're making a recommendation to you.
Us.
It will be part of the record, so the Council will have access to the full record.
Right.
So any testimony that comes before the Planning Commission, the Council can look at as well.
Right.
But their thoughts will be conveyed to the Council regardless of whether we agree with them or not.
Correct.
Right, okay.
Correct.
Yeah. Okay. Because I think originally, wasn't it, Troy, you presented the idea originally of possibility of ADUs in the historic district, wasn't it your thought?
I don't know that it was, but I'm...
Oh, okay,
I'm
okay, saying, I don't
yeah.
want to...
Okay, yeah. okay.
Because yeah, sure. I think the original thought was looking at interior ADUs as the only possibility.
Yeah.
And evidently the Historic Commission expanded upon that to look at all aspects of ADUs.
Yes, there was a comment that said, and I'm not all that familiar with the Washburn. I haven't worked with it. I haven't done a lot of historic work. But what was mentioned at the meeting is that it would be difficult to add on to an existing structure to build an accessory dwelling, because then that means you're removing some material to do so. So I think either interior in an existing structure or completely separate new building would be the most likely ways that you could add on.
Add an ADU in the historic district.
Right. Mm-hmm. But adding onto an existing structure would be problematic.
Yeah. That makes sense.
That's what I recommended, the interior ADUs.
Right. Yeah.
Specifically for Washburn.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'm overall, actually, I don't know who's on the Historic Commission, but I guess I thought they might go a little bit of a different direction, so I'm. And I noted that they their recommendations 2 days before a lot of concurring opinions from the open house. So the open house, assuming that was separate people, seemed to concur a lot with the Historic Commission decision 2 days before. And overall, I'm excited that that's the feedback that we got. So I think that's generally what I was hoping for that district specifically. And I still have some reservations about, as do they, although on opposing sides, I believe, the owner-occupied piece. I would like to personally see both be allowed to be rentals. They are still mulling that over a little bit, but other than that, I think I'm excited about the conclusion that they've come to, and they know more about the specificity of the Washburn rules than I do.
Yes.
If they agree, I'm excited to see that this is what they thought. Yeah.
Good. Yes.
Question for Catherine. If they're in the Washburn district, aren't already two doors on the same side that couldn't be changed anyway with the Washburn rules, right? Because you couldn't change the exterior, right?
Well, I don't think there's a complete prohibition against making any change. There's a process, and you have to meet criteria. And so I'm not comfortable making a generalization that you can't change it.
Oh, okay.
You have to dig into their rules a little bit deeper.
Okay.
Yeah, sure. I'm also not certain that, you know, if there's an existing building that has two perfectly good doors facing the same street, and it logically leads you to have that second one an ADU, I think a complete prohibition against it is a little bit pointless.
Those are good points that I can look into and talk with planners and see how would we deal with those situations, mm-hmm. you know, and how do we draft the language such that we're trying to be clear about what is or is not allowed, because we haven't drafted code language to address that yet.
Yeah.
And I had one other comment. At one point we talked about non-paved access off of alleys. And I think you came to the conclusion, we've come to the conclusion, that the city would require paving. And I was wondering if there might be a way around that. Number one, the idea that if you paved an alley, or if you paved your parking, and then later the alley was developed, your grade is probably not going to be correct anyway, because your alley is going to be built to slope and drain and stuff, and it may not meet existing ground. So you'd be required to re-improve your alley to fit it. So you're basically doing your alley twice, or the city would have to.
Well, my understanding is so, if you're taking access from the alley, that you are required to bring it up to city standards.
And however. I was thinking there might be a potential in this to require what's called irrevocable development, irrevocable condition, I think it's called, where you put a bond down and say, if the alleyway comes through, I will participate and pay for part of the alley improvements, and I'll also be sure to pave my driveway. So if they were able to attach conditions like that to the property, and then if the alley was developed, I think that would cover it, if I'm not mistaken.
So that could be part of your recommendation to council, because okay. that has a broader policy implication beyond the accessory dwellings in terms of policies around public improvements. But you can make a recommendation to council to consider that.
Consider.
When you get to your final recommendation.
It's actually called an irrevocable petition.
Right. Yes, for public improvement.
Usually the alley has a lot of people down it too. It's not just one person.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So on to the public comments portion.
Go
right ahead. You want to cover some of the other...
Go ahead and do that, and I was just asking you here.
Yes. I see that one of these comments was make the maximum size 750 square feet, or 10%, has to do with how much dwelling unit space can be on the property, and that really is not where we're headed with that. Is that correct? I mean, we're allowing our kind of our recommendation moving forward is more flexible than that, based on, but I'm sure there is some limitation of how much roof space there can be on a given property in the current code.
Yes.
Right?
I mean, we're not proposing any changes to lot coverage.
Yeah.
But we are not also saying that it has to be on one or two floors, other than the accessory dwelling can't be taller than the main dwelling. So the square footage of the ADU is not necessarily directly tied to lot coverage if you've got the ability to go vertical.
Right. Okay. Other questions? Yes.
Not necessarily on the public comments, but
yes.
Separately. I guess in reading through the thing, page 6 of 9, paragraph A2, you talk about some of the building standards required for the ADUs, you know, like how high the slats need to be and things like that. I wonder if it ought to say something to the effect of that the ADU needs to be made of, you know, not necessarily the same. You specifically say it doesn't have to be made the same as the home, but it ought to be materials comparable in quality to that used in the surrounding neighborhood. You know, if somebody drags in something that, you know, that they put wheels under and it kind of looks like junk, and maybe it satisfies the building code, then we haven't enhanced the neighborhood. We haven't done anything except take all the neighbors off.
So the challenge with that approach is that you're starting to introduce some discretion in terms of comparing it to the neighborhood.
That's true.
So
it's true.
If you can think about how you would characterize the neighborhood, and does that apply citywide, and then what would the requirements be that we could have put in here, I think we could take that approach. So when you're comparing it to the neighborhood, what are you looking at, and how can you articulate that in a clear standard?
It becomes very subjective.
I understand it is kind of loosey-goosey, but yeah, I think it's, and maybe you can't even do anything about it, but you know, to put in there that this thing kind of needs to stay within the character of the neighborhood, as opposed to looking like you wheeled in a bicycle and put a house on it.
Our attorney has a comment.
If I can interject to give some background, I think what Sandy's getting at, there was a Senate bill that was passed this last session, Senate Bill 1051, that I think that will come to you at some point with an educational item or maybe some proposed code changes to implement, but it clarified that the needed housing statutes that require clear and objective standards only for housing apply to all housing that you've identified as one way you're going to fill your housing requirement. And so ADUs were specifically identified in the residential land use element that the city adopted a few years ago. And so we have to have clear and objective, we have to give a clear and objective way for each standard to be met.
Right.
So we can have a discretionary option if a developer wants something different, but we, by state law, have to make our standard clear and objective.
Okay. Do we have standards that talk about, you know, insulation and, you know, energy efficiency and foundation, stuff like that?
The energy efficiency would be in the building code.
Yeah.
Okay, so those still very much apply.
Absolutely.
Okay, that's all I have to say.
The foundation piece, it needs to be secured, but I don't think the building code necessarily requires a foundation. So it can be tied down to posts, you know, but not necessarily a full foundation.
A concrete.
Wheels
foundation.
Removed.
That's what scares me.
So, I mean, that is something that...
Well, clearly, you could say, you know, mobile units, wheels must be removed, and they must be, axles removed, and it must be set on a... that's clear and objective.
Right. That is a standard. That's what I was trying to
that
say.
That is a
you
standard.
Could, write a standard about having a foundation and add that to your design standards.
So just something to consider. And that may, you know, I don't know what the city's, the city council's leaning is on that, but, I kind of like that. I think it makes it more of a permanent fixture and not just a quick way to cheaply, very cheaply, set something in the space that might meet the code that may not be appropriate. I mean, we're waiving SDCs. It's kind of a give and take. I think part of the owner's give, I think, is to, you know, part of this is a little bit of a commitment that this is going to be here for a while, and it is what it is. You have some feedback.
Yeah, a good spot to look if we want already written up language on that would be mortgage guidelines, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, and I can send them to you specifically. Clearly state what a manufactured home has to have in order to be purchased. There's 8 bullet points. It's pretty straightforward. Wheels removed, axles off, XXXX. So I could send them to you directly. But if it's public that anyone go look at Fannie Mae's guidelines on a manufactured home, they would come into play when that property went to be sold anyways in the future. So I don't think it would be any sort of burden to have them come into play when putting on a manufactured home now.
So how do you all feel about that?
Yeah, I think that's a good idea.
Yeah, it's already written out there. It's already about how you purchase manufactured homes.
So I think what you're hearing from the Planning Commission is a general consensus around that point, clear and objective standard that we would be interested in supporting.
So that means I can start thinking about some language to have ready.
Yeah. And Commissioner Dunn, could share that with...
I'll send you what I think would be a good start.
Okay.
Right, and I think back to council's direction, you know, the council did not give a lot of direction on this point. They said they wanted to be more flexible, but didn't want to allow shacks, and, you know, they were not very clear about what standards they did want or not. They left that to the process. Yeah. So, you know, I have given you an option, but if there are other standards that you think would be appropriate, I think that's certainly something to think about as you're trying to do that, what I talked about before, both remove the regulatory requirements but ensure compatibility mm-hmm. with the neighborhood. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I read the guidelines that I'll send to potential buyers who are looking at manufactured homes, when you read them, I always summarize it as, it has to look like a home. That's kind of my, like, you know, mm-hmm. personalization at the end. Like, if you read these, and if it meets these, it will look like a home. It will be a manufactured home, but it will look like a home.
But then you have to define that, too.
Well, but it's the 8 bullet points define it. That's my, it's my sort of layman's terms at the end. It's like, say, if you meet these 8 requirements, it will look like a home.
And that's my concern, you know, if you get somebody that looks like they just pulled a trailer into your neighborhood, you've given ADUs a really bad name.
Yeah.
You know, you've made all the neighbors angry, and we're not helping the city.
So I'll send the language. I think it would satisfy.
I think I hear we have general consensus that that's something we would be interested in supporting. Mm-hmm. So, okay, any other questions?
Yes. Same page. I'm wondering what we're doing on the window code under item D. So we're looking at Page six of nine.
That was about
six. The windows. Why would we want to make them match the existing house? I mean, I can kind of see that being aesthetic, but say the existing house has really tiny little kind of crummy windows, and you could have some nice windows. And I also don't see the thing about the window shall not be wider than it is tall, because I've got like sliders in my bathroom above the shower that are just wonderful windows. They're really wide and they're only about that tall. And then also picture windows. I mean, the old 1960s picture windows that were, and I have window walls in my house too that are, you know, like 9 feet wide and 5 feet tall. I mean, they're nice windows, I think. So I'm not sure what we're trying to do with the window standard, but.
Well, with each of these, we're trying to give a choice. You either match what's there or you have a different standard. In terms of the window, the alternate standard of no windows shall be wider than it is tall, if you don't feel that that's appropriate for Springfield, we can either remove any language about windows or come up with an alternative. That language is something I borrowed from Portland's code, and the idea, I think, is that many manufactured homes often have those orientation windows, and so in a sense you're trying to get them to look more like the home. But that's not necessarily going to be applicable. And so it's like you're thinking that, well, geez, some of these others, really, I like the look of those. And
well, I think there's a way to do, you know, there's a way to do windows that are going to be unaesthetic the way you've got it described, or to remove it and do it the way I've got it described. So I think, I wonder what we're, you know, what we're gaining.
But aren't we including just potentially divided sections? You know, like maybe I had like three windows that are together, and so yes, they're wider, but there's a sense of division. So ergo, each section is in fact taller than it is wide.
A thought I have on the windows, just from my perspective, on my house, I have two front windows that are pretty far apart, and they're about that wide and about that tall, and I hate them. And so my only two options, with that turning, doing an accessory dwelling unit would be match those windows or have more windows that are taller than they are wide. And I have to agree with you, Mike, that I really don't like the idea. Aesthetically, it's not pleasing to me, and I don't know who it is. It might be pleasing to other people, but I don't know that I should necessarily make it a standard.
Okay, so what I'm hearing, just to recap, is we have an issue with your D windows that you've taken from Portland or some other municipality. I think what you're hearing is we need to make this our own, and it needs to be an objective standard that gives a little more flexibility than what is outlined here.
Well, I mean, I guess, do you think there is a need for a standard about windows, and it's a matter of coming up with that, what that is?
A thought I have is that if you talked even about window trim, that would help. If you talked about window trim being similar to window trim on the house, then that could match the style.
Well, and it does. C does talk about that.
Then in that case, I think that window trim matching is probably enough regardless of size. So if you have a manufactured home, and I understand what you're talking about, like those really wide windows there just for looking through, about that much, they don't look nice. But I think that if we restrict the window trim, people that are going out of their way to get the proper window trim will probably have normal windows, house windows. I don't know. It's an assumption I'm making.
How do you write it?
What?
How would you write it?
I would say that D doesn't need to exist as long as we have C for the window trim. As long as your windows are clear glass, not anything weird, like stained or anything.
Well, this really refers only to windows on all street-facing facades.
Right.
If one of these dwelling units is in a backyard and you can't even see it from the street, would this even apply? No. So I think this is more geared toward possibly building onto an existing dwelling, potentially, or something of that nature. I don't know that it's necessary, but then again, I think that our code folks who deal with this kind of stuff all the time have a lot better sense of what makes sense in terms of development. And so, you know, I would just ask that that's a question we have. Is this necessary? Staff may say absolutely it is, but we can be a little more flexible in how this language is worded. So I would just direct staff, you know, I think it's our direction to take a look at this.
Yes.
We have some concerns about it. Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, other questions or comments at this stage?
It's a good review.
Excellent package of changes.
Very nice.
Yep.
I thought most of it just sounded great.
Mm-hmm.
Good.
Totally well, agree. We'll keep working at it, and hopefully by the time it's adopted, it'll be a good package.
Oh, it will be. It will be.
Yeah, it's already pretty good.
Springfield staff do amazing work. So, all right. Any other questions for Sandy in relation to our topic, work session topic this evening?
Did you want to hear what
yes,
you found out
I
about
would.
Parking?
Yes,
or
please.
Wait till your hearing.
Well, let's go ahead. We've got we're a little past our time frame, but can you do it in?
I can.
5 minutes.
So, the Department of Lands Conservation and Development did a survey of cities and their accessory dwelling unit requirements a year ago. So I looked at the results of that survey that included. There were 71 cities within that have parking requirements. So I looked at what those range were. So 3 cities actually require 2 parking spaces for the accessory dwelling unit. Overall, 45 out of the 71 require more parking than what Springfield is proposing. So. 8 have similar to what Springfield is proposing, and then 18 cities have fewer parking requirements than what Springfield is proposing. So, for example, 13 have no parking requirements at all.
Yes.
And that includes Portland. And I'll just speak to my own experience of having gone on the accessory dwelling unit tour in Southeast Portland. I was actually surprised that even though there was a tour going on, so people were driving to these different accessory dwellings, every single time I was able to find on-street parking on the same block, which surprised me given that Portland doesn't require any parking for the accessory dwellings. There are, in terms of being comparable to what Springfield is proposing, there are some different ways that they have gotten to it. So some cities looked at the width of the street instead of looking if there was on-street parking abutting. 4 cities looked at the width of the street and said that if the paved width was 28 feet, then no on-site parking was required. So they're looking at paved width rather than actual parking abutting the lot.
So you could park on either side in a situation like that.
Right. A couple cities looked at the street frontage. So if there was, in the case of Columbia City, 18 feet of street frontage, in the case of St. Helens, 20 feet of street frontage, then no on-site parking was required. Wilsonville was somewhat similar to Springfield, so that.
Did you mean street width there, 18 feet of street?
No.
Street
frontage.
Okay. Okay.
Which is a little interesting.
Yeah.
Can I interject real quick?
Yeah.
It probably is because that's the standard length for a parking on-street parking bay. So we have the same 18-foot reference in other sections of our code for credits for on-street parking for commercial uses.
Although it doesn't say whether, it just says street frontage, so it doesn't specify if there's a driveway there or not, which I thought was a...
Which is kind of goofy, so you can have a driveway.
That's probably where they got the numbers.
Right.
Yeah, yeah.
It's only going to be a driveway. I wouldn't suggest using that because I think it's problematic.
Excluding the driveway.
But I think that Christine is right, that that's the origin.
Yes, yeah, that's where it came from.
So in Wilsonville... they allow the on-street parking to meet the parking requirement if it's along the frontage of the lot or within 100 feet of the front lot line. And they also add that no more than 25% of the lots in the block will have ADUs.
So then you're limiting the number of ADUs in a block.
That's right.
Whoever gets to it first.
Whoever gets to it first.
The NEDA had they have a minimum of 2 combined spaces for the primary dwelling and ADU, plus 1 if no on-street parking abuts the property. So that was the most similar to what our proposal currently is. And then cities like the cities of Warrenton, Myrtle Point, Silverton, Medford, and only require 2 as a combined for the primary dwelling and ADU. And then Corvallis is similar in that they say no additional parking is required for the ADU if you have your primary dwelling parking is on site. So if you meet the minimum for your primary dwelling, then you don't have to add anything for the ADU. So to summarize, the codes that were surveyed back then, majority require 1 on-site parking space. 18 have none or more flexible than what we're proposing. The state, in a study that was done by DEQ, DLCD, and ODOT, recommends not requiring on-site parking, or if you are going to require it, that you waive it if there's transit available. So that is the state agency's recommendation in terms of the accessory dwellings. I thought it was interesting, it had come up during the open house as a concern.
Yeah, I don't think people really realize or think in terms of parking as a huge issue with ADUs, but I think it could be. Mm-hmm. Although you've indicated that some have not addressed it at all in there.
Right.
Code.
I think
yes.
The key is how liberal or how restricted the parking requirements are for the primary dwelling. And then you go feed off of that to what you allow to compensate for the primary for the ADU.
And there were some other ways of addressing it, that's why I wanted to highlight some of the other approaches that these cities took as an alternative to what we have now.
I think it'd be interesting for us to get that information that you just presented to us in a form that we can look at.
Okay.
And
digest.
Think about a little bit. You presented that really well, but I think we need to, as my wife's great uncle used to say, we need to cogitate on that a little mm-hmm. bit. We need to think about that.
You know,
give it some thought. I don't think we're going to be able to respond to that in this forum tonight. But I think it's good that you've done that research work, and I think we need to give it some thought.
Sure.
Okay. All right. Anything else? Any other questions? We stand adjourned.
Got a cog in.
So how did the
word cog?
48th Street.
How'd you say
cog it? I haven't heard that one. I don't know.
Yeah.